Welcome to the Denver Community Church Teaching Podcast. We're so glad that you're joining us today from wherever you are. Whether you attend one of our Denver locations or listen online, our hope is to explore and participate in the life of Jesus so that we can be a healing presence in our world. As you listen to this teaching, allow it to begin a conversation between you and God, you and the Bible, and you and your community. If you have any questions about DCC or this teaching, you can email us at info@denverchurch.org. And if you'd like to financially support our community and beyond as we set aside 20% of every dollar given to support our partners locally and around the globe, you can text the words Denver Church to 77977. That's Denver Church to 77977. Thank you for joining us today.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining with us online. If you'd like to follow along this morning, we will read from Matthew chapter 15. Now, if you've been with us the last several weeks, you know we've been teaching on God, the Bible, and violence. Asking, what do we do with the text in the Bible where God commands violence and genocide and ethnic cleansing? And in response to that, this week and next week, we will discuss how we can look at these troubling passages through the heart of Jesus and how that may help us reframe them. And so today we will explore what's really a disorienting story from the life of Jesus and his interaction with a Canaanite woman and what this might tell us about the heart of Jesus toward those who had long been considered enemies of Israel. So with that said, I'll begin reading from Matthew chapter 15 and verse 21. It says this, "Leaving that place, Jesus withdrew to the region of Tyre and Sidon. A Canaanite woman from that vicinity came to him crying out, 'Lord, Son of David, have mercy on me. My daughter is demon-possessed and suffering terribly.' Jesus did not answer a word. So his disciples came to him and urged him, 'Send her away, for she keeps crying out after us.' Jesus answered, 'I was sent only to the lost sheep of Israel.' The woman came and knelt before him. 'Lord, help me,' she said. He replied, 'It is not right to take the children's bread and toss it to the dogs.' 'Yes, it is, Lord,' she said. 'Even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table.' Jesus said to her, 'Woman, you have great faith. Your request is granted.' And her daughter was healed at that moment." Now, this is the most troubling story from the life of Jesus. A woman comes to him. She's desperate for the healing of her daughter, and Jesus ignores her, claims he's not here for her people or for her or her daughter, and then he calls her a dog. Now, you may expect me to say, well, actually, in the Greek, the original word here is, but I can't do that, because in the Greek, Jesus calls her and her people dogs. There's no getting around it. So what do we do with this? I mean, if Jesus really calls a woman a dog, do we accept it? Do we say, well, he's Jesus, so, you know, he must have a reason? And I suppose we could, and some actually have. Or we can dig in and ask, is there more going on here? And the answer, of course, is yes. And to understand that, we need to go way back toward the beginning of the sacred text to Genesis chapter 9. Now, if you're familiar with the story before Genesis 9 and Genesis 6, God calls a man named Noah to build an ark because there's going to be a flood and all of the life on earth will be destroyed. Noah builds the boat and he and his wife and his three sons and their wives along with animals are safely on the ark and they are saved. And when the floodwaters recede, Noah goes from being a ship builder to a gardener. And this is where we find ourselves in Genesis 9, beginning in verse 18. It says, "The sons of Noah who came out of the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Ham was the father of Canaan. These were the three sons of Noah, and from them came the people who scattered over the whole earth. Noah, a man of the soil, proceeded to plant a vineyard. When he drank some of its wine, he became drunk and lay uncovered, naked, inside his tent. Ham, the father of Canaan, saw his father naked and told his two brothers outside. But Shem and Japheth took a garment and laid it across their shoulders. Then they walked in backward and covered their father's naked body. Their faces were turned the other way, so they would not see their father naked. When Noah awoke from his wine and found out what his youngest son had done, he said, 'Cursed be Canaan, The lowest of slaves will he be to his brothers. He also said, praise be to the Lord, the God of Shem. May Canaan be the slave of Shem. May God extend Japheth's territory. May Japheth live in the tents of Shem. And may Canaan be the slave of both Shem and Japheth. After the flood, Noah lived 350 years. Noah lived a total of 950 years, and then he died. So Noah is a freshman in college who joined a fraternity. The dude gets inebriated, intoxicated, plowed, tanked, smashed, Hemingwayed, schnockered, hammered. He ties one on. He's three sheets to the wind, or as our Irish friends say, he's pissed as a fart. I can almost imagine him like stumbling around after he gets drunk. And he's like, you know, I built a boat. There was a lot of animals. I'm fine. I'm good, really. I'm not as think as you drunk I am. But I'm going to go lay down. And then apparently Noah, who's knackered from too much wine, zonks out in the raw. And while there were no iPhones there to record this moment, there is an inspired text that documents this escapade that has been widely available to readers for thousands of years. And then Noah wakes up following his bender, and he doesn't seem to have any like post-drunk shame or even say like, wow, that took a turn. No, immediately he unleashes on Canaan. Now, if anything, he may have a reason to be upset with Ham, but Canaan? Canaan wasn't even there. Commentators and rabbis and scholars agree on one thing. There has to be more to this story, right? Did something get left out? Because on its own, this story doesn't make any sense. And what's interesting is how many people assume Canaan must have done something to receive this kind of anger and curse. So what exactly did Canaan do? Well, no one knows. I mean, there's one scholar who actually argues, and I quote, "There can be no doubt the major function of this present narrative is to introduce the theme of the depravity of the Canaanites." And his opinion is but one example among many that simply don't question Noah's words or actions. I mean, we're fine questioning Canaan. I mean, we know, right? He was a bad seed. We know he must have done something, even though he wasn't there. Why is this? Why do we not ask questions of Noah? Why do we ignore the possibility that his actions and his words were wrong? Interesting, isn't it? I mean, after all, it's Noah who gets plastered and goes horizontal commando style and then curses Canaan when he's hungover. But our history of interpretation leads us to ask, what did Canaan do? As though Noah is blameless and without fault in this whole situation. And I point this out because this has led many to the conclusion that something is wrong with Canaan, or that these verses point to the depravity of Canaan. And we see this in the conjecture about Canaan by commentators, saying things like, well, Noah must have known Canaan was bad. Or, do you see how bad the Canaanites were from the very beginning? But why the reluctance to question Noah? Why the lack of conjecture about him? Why not say what's obvious? The guy got butt sloshed. He was so blitzed, he nodded off and went face down in the buff, and he slept it off, came out of his tent, and unloaded on his grandson who wasn't even there. Now, some commentary, albeit very little, has a different take on this, and honestly, it's rather refreshing. Rabbi Joseph Telushkin, talking about this passage, says this, "A problematic feature is Noah's curse. He directs it not against Ham, the son who uncovered or saw his nakedness, but against Canaan. Why? We don't know. Although in moments of rage, people often say inappropriate things, as, for example, laying a curse on the descendants of a person at whom they are enraged. Noah's imprecation against Canaan is a particularly unfortunate one, guaranteed to provoke intra-family hatred for generations." Telushkin observes these verses planted the seeds of hatred toward the people of Canaan from the very beginning. These verses, among others, became a foundation for how people thought about and felt about the Canaanites. And lest you forget, who the Canaanites are, the writer of Genesis follows this story in Genesis chapter 9 with the genealogy in Genesis chapter 10, and we learn of Canaan's sons, the firstborn being Sidon. His other sons are the fathers of the nations that are to be cleansed from the land by divinely sanctioned genocide. Now, it doesn't take much then to think, well, it's right to kill the Canaanites. It's right to show them no mercy and to enslave them. I mean, they're cursed by God. Forgetting they weren't cursed by God, they were cursed by an old man who drank too much. However, throughout the Old Testament, the Canaanites are commonly shown to be the most devious people imaginable. This message was internalized and became a root of violence. And among the many portrayals of evil that we see in the Canaanites, there's one in particular that scholars point to as the embodiment of all the insidiousness of the Canaanites. I'm talking about the woman Jezebel. Now, you know she's bad because just her name is an insult. And you've never met a couple who's like introducing you to their kids? Like, this is Roy, he's our oldest, and this is Debbie, our little athlete. Huh, meet our son Bob, he's the family comedian, and our youngest sweet little Jezebel. Like, hey, say hey, Jezebel, and she's like, right? I mean, Jezebel embodies evil. And how are we introduced to her? Well, according to 1 Kings chapter 16, she's the daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians. Remember, the Sidonians were the descendants of Sidon, the oldest son of Canaan, and Canaan was cursed by his grandfather, Noah. Generations after Noah's binge, we learn about Jezebel's evil by pointing to her ethnicity. Jezebel is a Sidonian woman, a Canaanite, who lived in the region of Tyre. This is a representative of the intra-family hatred that hung in the Jewish consciousness for thousands of years. Imagine what that can do. When I was 8 years old, I went with my family and a few others to a hockey game, but this was not just like any hockey game. It was the United States versus the USSR, or Russia, for my millennial and Gen Z friends. And it wasn't just the United States versus the USSR. The game was actually in Lake Placid, New York, in the very same arena, on the very same ice, where just 4 years earlier, the US beat the Russians in the Winter Olympics in a game known today as the Miracle on Ice. Now, I was not fully aware of the Cold War or the arms race and the geopolitical realities of the world. I mean, I was only 8 years old, and I wasn't a nerd back then like I am now. But what I did know is this: Russia, or USSR, was a synonym for evil. I knew that a Russian was a terrible person. I knew that everything they were was bad, and everything we were was righteous. And this belief was something that I like picked up in the air from overhearing conversations, and especially from American television and movies that always depicted Russians in the worst possible light. They hated us. They hated freedom. And that night at the hockey game, that belief was on full display. When the Russians would score a goal, the crowd booed and hurled insults. And when we scored a goal, the crowd cheered and hurled more insults. I mean, people said horrible things. And then we ended up winning the game. And we won the same way that we won 4 years earlier. We scored a last-second goal. And that last-second goal, it just fueled the hatred and vitriol and name-calling. And I'm telling you, what came out of the mouths of those people in that little arena in Lake Placid, New York, was unbelievable. It was actually like Facebook. Now, keep in mind, this hatred between these two countries at that game in late 1983 was only decades old. So just imagine what kind of hate can fester and grow and build a head of steam when it's thousands of years old. Keep in mind, by the time that we get to Matthew chapter 15, when Jesus encounters this Canaanite woman, this hatred that began with Noah had simmered for thousands of years. And maybe this can help us understand what's going on with Jesus in that story and what he might just be getting at. So with that in mind, let's go back to Matthew 15 and unpack some of the details. First off, we learn that Jesus is in the region of Tyre and Sidon. Sidon? Remember him, the firstborn of Canaan? Yeah, Jesus is in the region where his descendants live. Jesus is in Canaanite territory. And who greets him when he gets there? A woman. But not just any woman, a woman from that region, a Sidonian woman. You see what Matthew is doing here? Who epitomizes and embodies the evil of the Canaanites? A Sidonian woman named Jezebel. I mean, Matthew even refers to this woman as a Canaanite, just in case readers were not picking up what he's laying down. Which means, as Matthew paints the scene, it's tense and it's uncomfortable, both for the disciples and the reader. It's tense from the beginning. Then the woman makes a request of Jesus, and Jesus completely ignores her. He pretends that she's not there, which is interesting because throughout the Gospels, Jesus always hears the cry of people, but here he behaves differently. He won't give her the time of day. And what is the reaction of the disciples? They urge him, send her away, which, by the way, is the same exact phrase they use when Jesus feeds the 5,000 in Matthew chapter 14. Send them away. Except in that story, Jesus says to them, they don't need to go away. You give them something to eat. But here they say, send her away. And Jesus' reply to them, I was only sent to the lost sheep of Israel. Which is to say, yeah, I'm not here for her. Now, here's an important detail. Notice I said Jesus' reply to them and not to her. Because there's actually two conversations happening here. The woman is speaking to Jesus, and the disciples likewise are speaking to Jesus. And we see as the story unfolds, Jesus is having a conversation with both, with the disciples and with the woman. So when he speaks of being sent only to the lost sheep of Israel, he's saying this to his disciples. But even Jesus talking about only being sent to the lost sheep of Israel, it doesn't make sense, and here's why. It appears there that Jesus is explaining why he's ignoring her and not healing her, and he's saying, I'm not here for her. However, there are multiple stories in the Gospels, including in Matthew before this event, where Jesus is healing Gentiles. So if he intends as an explanation as to why he will not heal her or respond, it really makes her a pretty flimsy excuse. Regardless of what he says, the woman kneels in front of Jesus and she says, Lord, help me. And then he speaks to her for the first time. And he says, it is not right to take the children's bread and toss it to the dogs. This is troubling. How do you make sense of Jesus calling a woman, one who bears the divine image, a mother, throwing herself at the feet of Jesus for the sake of her daughter? How do you make sense of him calling her a dog? Keep in mind, Jesus had harsh warnings for how we treat one another, even how we speak to and about one another. So why does he use what really is a racial slur? This has to bother us. Regardless of what Jesus says, this woman, this loving mother, she fires right back at Jesus. She says, yes, it is. Even the dogs eat the crumbs from their master's table. And only then does Jesus commend her faith and heal her daughter. This is really confounding. And what is most troubling is the number of people who defend Jesus' words here as though they're okay because, well, you know, he's Jesus. Keep in mind how much violence is planted in the soil of separateness and superiority, especially along racial and ethnic lines. If we give this story a pass, rather than dive deep, we can uphold this kind of thinking and the systems and structures that perpetuate this kind of thinking that often leads to violence. And one thing we witness in the life of Jesus is that he is not interested in participating in those systems, and he condemns the structures that uphold this sort of thing. Which means what we see here with Jesus, it may not be what it first appears to be. Now, here's why I say that. First, at the start of Jesus' ministry recorded in Luke chapter 4, Jesus is in his hometown of Nazareth. He's at the synagogue on Sabbath, and he reads from the scroll of Isaiah saying, the Spirit of the Lord is on me because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners and recovery of sight for the blind, to set the oppressed free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." And he follows this reading by saying, "And today, this scripture is fulfilled in your hearing." And that did not go over so well. The people begin to say, "Isn't this Joseph and Mary's son?" So in response, Jesus says to those listening from Luke chapter 4, "Truly I tell you, no prophet is accepted in his hometown. I assure you that there were many widows in Israel in Elijah's time, when the sky was shut for 3.5 years and there was a severe famine in the land. Yet Elijah was not sent to any of them, but to a widow in Zarephath in the region of Sidon." His point is this: don't think I'm only here for all of you. And if you don't want me around here, there are others who do. And to make his point, he speaks of the prophet Elijah and his kindness toward a woman from Sidon, a story in which Elijah heals her child. Second, Jesus references Sidon elsewhere in speaking to the religious. In Matthew chapter 11, this is what he says to them: "Woe to you, Chorazin! Woe to you, Bethsaida!" Two very religious towns, Chorazin and Bethsaida. "Woe to you! For if the miracles that were performed in you had been performed in Tyre and Sidon, they would have repented long ago in sackcloth and ashes. But I tell you, it will be more bearable for Tyre and Sidon on the day of judgment than it will be for you." In other words, Jesus is saying, the hearts of the Sidonians and the Canaanites, they're not as hard as yours, and it will be better for them one day. Beyond these two examples, Jesus moves freely in and out of Tyre and Sidon. Now, these are places no good, observant Jewish person would ever go. But for Jesus, we just begin to recognize that he's at home anywhere. So if this is what Jesus is saying and doing in other stories found in the Gospels, then what is Jesus getting at in this story, in this interaction with this loving Canaanite mother and his disciples? Why is he behaving and speaking in a way that is not consistent with who we know Jesus to be? And that is a great question, so thank you for asking. Let me suggest this. I don't think that Jesus is revealing what's in his heart. Rather, he is revealing and exposing the heart of his disciples. And Matthew, in recording this story, is exposing the heart of the reader. Jesus, in this moment, well, he's playing the part of like the trickster or the jester or the sacred fool. Now, this is an archetypal figure who reveals truth, but does so in an innocent way, in a playful way. And he does so by holding up a mirror that reflects who we are. Now, the power of the jester or the trickster is they reflect back to us what we find too painful or too shameful to admit to ourselves. They are masters at using humor or jest or satire to expose our ignorance, our weakness, our arrogance, our prejudice. They offer us a chance to peer behind the masks as individuals and as a society. And this is exactly what we see Jesus doing here. He is behaving the way the disciples would have behaved. And in doing so, he actually reveals their prejudice. He's acting aloof, you know? He's like, she's crying, he's kind of looking around like she's not there. He's acting ignorant or innocent, like he's only about Israel and nobody else. And what do the disciples do? I mean, how do they respond? They cry out, "Send her away. We don't want to help her either." And in that very moment, Jesus reveals what is in their hearts in a way that confrontation or reprimand never could. I mean, if Jesus had looked at his disciples and said, "You're a bunch of prejudiced bigots," they likely would not have been like, "You're right, you got us, sorry." If he had said, "Hey guys, how do you feel about Sidonian women?" Or "Hey guys, the way you feel about Sidonian women, it's wrong." Would they have responded honestly? It's worth noting, research shows that when we feel threatened as humans, we don't venture toward honesty and vulnerability. And so Jesus plays the sacred fool. And in this moment, the disciples are exposed. They are left not to argue with Jesus, but with their actions and their words and are left holding what was revealed in their heart. This is genius. This is similar, actually, to the subversive work of Sacha Baron Cohen. Now, if you're not familiar with him, he has several characters or really alter egos. There's Ali G, there's Bruno. His most famous character is Borat. Some of you right now are like, are you comparing Jesus to Borat? Yes, I am, as a way of observing what Jesus did in this story. Jesus is just a lot cleaner than Borat. What Cohen does as Borat is he goes into the most uncomfortable situations and he plays the fool. He pretends to be innocent. He pretends to be ignorant. And in doing so, he reveals what is in the heart of those who made it into his first film and his subsequent movie film. Now, this is an age-old form of comedy. It's the jester in front of the king, playing the fool while at the same time revealing truth with humor, and in doing so, holding up a mirror in such a way that the truth is so clear it can't be denied. In our world today, our tricksters, our jesters, our sacred fools are really stand-up comedians. They're the prophets of our day. I mean, nothing is off limits for them. And they say things that are hard to hear. And they frame them in such a way where there's like this innocence or this humor that's tied to them. And in doing so, they hold up a mirror to us and our culture. Dave Chappelle actually just last week in his monologue on Saturday Night Live, he pointed to this. He said, "I can't even tell something true unless it has a punchline behind it." And he's right. Sort of. Because even today, comedians are finding it hard to say what's true, even with a punchline behind it. Now, I am aware that some people, maybe even some of you here, you may be upset by many stand-up comedians, especially those who offer social commentary. Many people find them offensive, and some comedians certainly are. So that's fair. But let's be honest. Our being upset isn't necessarily a sign of like our intellectual prowess or because they are so offensive or because we are more competent than others or even because of our unflagging commitment to an egalitarian vision. Our being upset may well be due to our lacking a sense of humor and taking ourselves way too seriously. And so we protest, and we do the really effective thing of going to social media to cancel them and call them out and demand censorship. Now, if you don't know what I'm talking about, just Google the name Sebastian Montescalco and the bit that he did last year's MTV Music Awards and the attending outrage of people at his set. It's worth mentioning, by the way, that we want to repress and censor people. And the repression of humor and the censoring of satire is one of the textbook moves of authoritarian regimes. And today, we see authoritarian leanings on both the right and the left in our country. Now, I take time to point out it's both left and right because it's possible some of you heard me say authoritarian regimes and tendencies and you immediately thought of President Trump. I mean, you know how angry he gets and he goes on a Twitter rampage when he's portrayed in an unflattering light or he's mocked like on shows like SNL. Aha, you say. You're right. No humor. And by the way, you'd be right to observe that because it's definitely there. But before you get too far down that road or gloat over your keen perception and in doing so let yourself off the hook, it may be worth noting that several years ago, many stand-up comedians talked about how they no longer do shows at universities. And they pointed to the students' inability to laugh at themselves anymore and their near allergic reaction to any form of criticism and their outcry for censoring anything that might upset them. And now it's not just at universities. I mean, comedians are talking about how this is something that's true in our broader culture more and more and more. They observe with humor and satire how many people find it hard to laugh at themselves because of their fragility, or how they fear laughing at the wrong thing because of how quickly people are canceled for saying or doing the wrong thing, even if they said or did the wrong thing 15 years ago. They speak of how our culture increasingly feels like, to borrow another line from Dave Chappelle, how it feels like a woke meeting. Now, it's entirely possible the problem is not always the comedians or the prophets. the tricksters or the jesters or the sacred fools. It's possible the problem is us. It is you and it is me. We don't want to look in the mirror. We don't want to be honest. We don't want to admit what bothers us is not the truth cloaked in humor. What bothers us is how true it actually is. And we don't want to look because what we find might be too painful or too shameful to admit to ourselves. So we decline the chance to peer behind the masks as individuals and behind the masks of our society. Now, this shouldn't surprise us because even as playful and innocent as tricksters seem, the mirror they hold up is piercing because we can't deny it. We cannot deny the truth they reveal. And so we have to look somewhere. And so in the end, we insist that the problem's out there. You know who's the problem? Those cursed Canaanites. And my friends, anytime we believe that, violence is not far behind. This is what Jesus is getting at. This is what Jesus unearths in his disciples. Jesus revealed what was there the whole time in a masterful act of teaching as their innocent sage, as the trickster. But here's what I think we can miss in all this. This is Jesus we're talking about. He doesn't reflect back to his disciples to make them feel bad. He's not standing there in condemnation. No, Jesus is unearthing this for the sake of liberation, for salvation, for healing. You know, we get defensive because it's difficult to look within, to be honest, to have things revealed about ourselves that we wish were not true, to have a mirror held up to our bias and prejudice and behaviors and loathe what we see. I know this is true from my own experience, but I can also tell you from my own experience, if we are willing to look within, to be honest about what we see, that necessary first step has the power to lead us on a journey toward healing and peace within us. Then we can become those who live as a healing presence in our world. Then we can be those who are messengers of peace. Or we can refuse to look within. We can blame, we can ignore, we can deny, we can nurse our grudges, and we can let our wounds fester. And I can say this with confidence from my own experience. None of that will lead to healing and to peace. It will only lead to bitterness and anger and hatred and violence. And therein is the power of this story. The power of the story between Jesus and this woman. The power is that it holds up a mirror. And in doing so, it invites us to make a choice. Will we be honest about what is within us? Or will we continue to deny what is there? The power of the story is that it gives us a choice, but it does not give us a choice about making a choice. And so, what will you choose? Let's pray together. God, we thank you, as difficult as it is, for these stories, these subversive stories that hold up a mirror to us, for stories that undo our illusions, for stories that challenge the narrative that we've clung to, the beliefs that we hold to be true about others. We thank you that these disrupt us, that these cause us to be uncomfortable, that these invite us ultimately to be honest about what we see so that we might find greater healing and we might find greater peace. We thank you that it leads us to those places so that we can join you in the healing that you wish to bring to this world, in the good news of peace that Jesus came to bring. I ask as we contemplate what we will choose, that you would strengthen us, cause us to be courageous so that we might be honest, so that we might find healing. We pray these things together in the strong name of Jesus. And all my friends said together online, amen.